Hey, good morning, everybody, to Human Anatomy Bio 231. And it's Monday, July 13th. Let's take a look at the schedule pretty soon. See if I can clip in here. Oh, that's good. Okay, so here is your schedule. Today is the 13th. We're going to get into central nervous system today. First, we're going to finish up the introductory chapter to nervous system. You had a practicum last time. I hope I put all those grades in Blackboard. I know I got them graded. Did you see your grades in Blackboard, anybody? Yeah, good. Okay, they should be there. And you'd be able to check them out later today in lab if you want to. Or if you didn't see your lecture exam from the day before that, you can look at that. And then we're going to get into central nervous system, chapter 13. Peripheral on Tuesday, autonomic nervous system Wednesday, special senses on Thursday. So this is a big week. We're going to cover a bunch of material. And then next week, Monday, we have a lecture exam on endocrine system. That's chapter 17. Then Tuesday, a week and one day from today, is exam number 3. And then you're about 3/4 of the way done with the class after that point. So the chapters on the next exam are going to be 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. So everything that we've been talking about, starting with fundamentals of nervous system. And there are some details in that endocrine system, so don't put that off studying until Monday of next week. Kind of start looking that over now and so that you can study it really efficiently over the weekend coming up. Okay, because, you know, you just have to do repetition, work repetition to understand some of this stuff. All right, does anybody have a question over the schedule? Or what we're doing in class, or any kind of question like that? Pretty good? Okay, let's just review really quickly what we covered last time. So I'm going to put the schedule away. And so here is that flow diagram that you should use to understand the nervous system. So it breaks it down into its components. Sometimes it's a functional, sometimes structural component. So if you're going to take the nervous system, how many divisions can you break the whole nervous system down into? The two most general. We have central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. And you know the central nervous system to be the brain and the spinal cord, right? In the dorsal body cavity, and the peripheral nervous system is everything outside the brain and spinal cord. So we just call that peripheral as opposed to central. And just like we can break the whole nervous system down into two divisions, we can break the peripheral nervous system down into two major divisions. There is the afferent division and efferent division. And you just got to be aware of what afferent stands for. What does afferent mean? Afferent is signals going from the periphery into the central nervous system or sensory. Efferent, on the other hand, is when we have information originating in the central nervous system and it's leaving the CNS going to the periphery someplace. That's the efferent or motor division. And just like what we can break the peripheral nervous system down into two major divisions, the motor or efferent division we can break down into two major divisions. There's somatic and autonomic. So somatic goes to your periphery, because we're talking peripheral nervous system, to places that are not deep inside body cavities, and it's only voluntary, it's part of your voluntary nervous system. And you know the effector organ for the voluntary nervous system, or somatic, is skeletal muscle, right? That's the only thing that you can voluntarily control in your body. So somatic is the skeletal muscle, and that's different from the autonomic nervous system. Part of the peripheral, it goes to deep organs inside body cavities and a few other places in other peripheral places like blood vessels, right, that little erector pili muscle and skin, places like that. But mostly think of it deep inside body cavities. Autonomic goes to visceral organs. You don't have conscious control of that. Autonomic nervous system takes care of the rest of your body for you without your conscious thought. And the autonomic nervous system. Okay, well, let me go back to somatic. Somatic goes to skeletal muscle, and skeletal muscle, your skeleton is controlled by a very important property of control systems, and that is if you want to have precise control and balance of something, what should that control system consist of? It should consist of two major divisions, right? Two major divisions. And what's the relationship between those two major divisions that even that we see in the somatic muscle system, somatic nervous system? The relationship is they're antagonistic to each other, right? Gas pedal, brake pedal. So in the musculoskeletal system, your voluntary control, how is antagonism built into that system all by itself? That's an intrinsic property of the musculoskeletal system. Antagonism. Could somebody give me an example of antagonistic control in your musculoskeletal system? Biceps, triceps, brachii, right? So one will cause flexion, the other extension. One might cause abduction, the other adduction. One might cause right lateral rotation, the other left lateral rotation. So it's the balance of those two muscles that give you precise control and balance, even though they are antagonistic to each other. So that's built into the somatic nervous system. Autonomic, on the other hand, is not built in automatically. The autonomic nervous system has to have two divisions, right? The sympathetic and parasympathetic. And what's the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system? Yeah, they're going to be antagonistic to each other so that you have precise control and balance. Well, for the somatic nervous system, right, the effector organ is skeletal muscle, but for the autonomic nervous system, what are the effector organs? What are these things that can produce a response in the autonomic nervous system? They are smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. These are things you don't have control over, right? They're taken care of automatically for you. So when we study all these chapters in nervous system, make sure that you can fit your understanding or discussion into this flow diagram. It's a really nice concept map of the nervous system. Okay, so we looked at a response loop last time. How many different kinds of cells? Major kinds of cells make up the nervous system tissue. If you think of nervous system tissue, you can break it down into a couple categories. Does anybody know how many categories we can break all the cells down into? I think I heard, yeah, there's two. One is neurons, and the other are support cells, or neuroglia cells. Neuroglia cells are a little bit different, whether they're in the CNS or PNS, and CNS just stands for central nervous system, PNS, peripheral nervous system. So let's review, what are the support cells in the central nervous system? You have, shown on the slide right here, astrocytes. And you should know what the function of an astrocyte is, but be able to identify it by its particular shape. That's an exam figure. Then we have microglia cells, or microglial cells, part of your immune response. Right? So and then the third kind, ependymal cells. It lines cavities inside the brain. It helps make cerebrospinal fluid, which is that fluid that fills the cavities inside the brain, which I hope we can get to today. And then the fourth kind, oligodendrocytes. They're responsible for putting myelin sheaths around axons in the central nervous system. They are a counterpart to myelinating cells in the peripheral nervous system. What do we call those myelinating cells in the peripheral nervous system? Those are, I see them right here, Schwann cells, right? And that, so oligodendrocytes and the Schwann cells, in some sense, are very similar because they speed up the rate of a nerve impulse down an axon. That's their job. From maybe 4 or 5 miles an hour to hundreds of miles an hour, a lot faster. Okay, so what's better? Faster or slower? Faster, right? It's like one of those commercials you've been seeing, right? What's better, faster or slower? Faster is better, right? So myelinated axons are faster, that's better. And the other kind of support cell in the peripheral nervous system are satellite cells that we find around cell bodies of sensory neurons. And maybe you can even recognize this particular neuron as a sensory neuron. Right, this gold color right here, here's the cell body, single process coming out that bifurcates into a central and peripheral process. Peripheral meaning just coming from the peripheral nervous system. The central process is going into the central nervous system. And this is what a unipolar neuron, because it just has one projection. And sometimes people call it a pseudo-unipolar because it bifurcates into actually two processes, right? So pseudo-unipolar sensory neuron. All right, so we got support cells or neuroglia cells. What's the other kind of nervous system cell? I was talking about it right here. It is neurons, right? So neurons make up the other division of cells of the nervous system. Here is one that you have to identify by shape. This is a pseudo-unipolar. And there are a couple others you have to identify by shape and by function. That is the multipolar and also bipolar neurons. And neurons are different than support cells because they do collect information on dendrites or the cell body and then send information down an axon. So they transmit electrical nerve impulses. Support cells do not, but neurons do. All right, so that's a pretty quick review of what we talked about last time. Oh, we also looked at a synapse last time, right? That's a structural and functional unit of communication between cells. And in particular, we looked at a chemical synapse in which the information is passed from the pre to the postsynaptic cell via a chemical signal. Does anybody know what that chemical signal is called? Generally speaking, the chemical signal. Where do we have it? Right here. Okay, that chemical signal that goes across the synaptic cleft and communicates with the postsynaptic cell is called a neurotransmitter, right? And what is your favorite neurotransmitter? Some people might say serotonin. Some people might say dopamine. Some people might say acetylcholine because it's the most prevalent, right? But all these are important in various parts of the nervous system and even more than that. Okay, so here's the presynaptic cell, here's the postsynaptic cell. Okay, let's get into some definitions. And you know what, before I do that, I want to pull up a picture of a neuron. Ah, here's a good picture of a neuron. Okay, so nervous system terms. This is just some terminology that you should be familiar with. Gray matter. What the heck is gray matter? Gray matter you can see with your naked eye, so it's a gross structure. Gray matter is neurons that don't have myelin around them. So what parts of a neuron are unmyelinated? It's always going to be dendrites and cell body. But axons, right, if there are Schwann cells or oligodendrocytes around them, then they're going to look white because myelin is a white-looking compound. All right, so gray matter is just a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And we're talking about in probably central nervous system is the best way to think of this. Okay, the central nervous system cortex. Sometimes we call that gray matter. What do we find on the surface? Remember, cortex is the superficial part of any organ. So gray matter, the CNS cortex, gray matter, what do we find on the cortex of the central nervous system, at least in the brain? Superficial on the brain. Gray matter is going to be made up of what? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites. That's what's going to be very superficial. And if we have a group of these nerve cell bodies and dendrites, like on the cortex or even deep inside the brain, they're going to look gray because they don't have myelin around them. We're going to call that a nucleus, right? A nucleus is just a whole group of these nerve cell bodies and dendrites deep inside the central nervous system, and it looks gray, and it's going to stand out from the rest of the central nervous system that looks white. All right, so there's really good contrast. All right, so nucleus, what could a nucleus be? Well, in science, one word can mean a lot of different things. Like the nucleus could be a nucleus of an atom. A nucleus could be the nucleus of a cell that contains genetic material. In terms of gross anatomy, a nucleus and the nervous system means a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Okay, and it's going to look different than other parts of the central nervous system. All right, so nuclei, group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites deep inside the central nervous system, that's plural. Otherwise, we're going to call it a nucleus if it's just singular. This is a little bit more modern nomenclature. Your book really hasn't caught on to that modern nomenclature. There are some nuclei deep inside the brain that have been referred to ganglia for decades, and people still refer to them as ganglia, but probably in your discussions and your thinking, you should just call them a nucleus. Because a ganglion has a different meaning. A ganglion is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, All right, so what color is a ganglion going to be if it has nerve cell bodies and dendrites? It's going to be non-myelinated, so it's going to look gray. But this gray matter is not in the central nervous system. It's going to be located in the peripheral nervous system. All right, so a nucleus and a ganglion are pretty much exactly the same thing, except one's in the central nervous system and the other is in the peripheral nervous system. That's why we don't really like to say basal ganglia anymore for things deep inside the brain, but that's what a lot of people still use. All right, so nucleus, ganglion, gray matter. Well, since there's gray matter, there's got to be another kind. And here is white matter. White matter just means that it's going to be some part of a neuron that has myelin around it, right? That speeds up the nerve conduction. In the peripheral nervous system, they're Schwann cells. Central nervous system, they're oligodendrocytes. And so these are axons that are going someplace, transmitting nerve impulses very rapidly. So they're going to be called white matter. And white matter can exist in the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system. If it's in the central nervous system, we're going to call it a tract. And tracts are like big cables that are carrying information in one direction. Remember, a nerve impulse can only go in one direction along a neuron. Who can tell me what that direction is of a nerve impulse? Or do you think a neuron like what I'm showing right here can carry information both directions? Which way is it, both or one way? It's one way. And which is that way? From dendrite to cell body down an axon. Right, so this axon is sending information. If it's myelinated, it's going to be white matter. If there are a group of these in the central nervous system, we call it a tract. Right, so there's tracts in the central nervous system, and they have to go around nuclei, the gray areas. If we have white matter in the peripheral nervous system, we're just going to call that a nerve, a plain old nerve. They're a little bit different because nerves have more connective tissue around them, might even have their own blood vessels. Not so for tracts. Right, but they're still going to have that appearance of being white. Okay, we talked about nerve impulses, speedy versus slow. Right, if it's slow, it's continuous. If it's fast, it's saltatory. But don't forget, it also has to be a myelinated axon. Okay, so what does a nerve look like? Let's take a look at a nerve. I think I have a nerve someplace. Ah, here's a nerve. All right, so we've looked at a muscle before. And was that on your last test? Ah, that was on your last test already, so we're past that. All right, so let's see. If you have a whole muscle, you can break it down into fascicles, and there's fine structure in fascicles. You can break them down into muscle cells. And then even within a cell, you have those myofibrils, which are the organelles for contraction. And you can even break the myofibrils down into myofilaments, right? So there's a nice order of how all these things are put together. Well, sort of the same thing for a nerve. So here is a very nice illustration of a nerve. And where would we find this particular nerve? In the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system? Where do we have nerves? Okay, and I've taken it off the slide already over here, so maybe I can go back. Where is the nerve located? Peripheral nervous system, right? So this beast that we're looking at on the right-hand side is found in the peripheral nervous system. And so what do we see? We see a whole nerve with a connective tissue sheath around it. That's called the epineurium. And if we look inside deep to the epineurium, we see things, little bundles, which we call fascicles, pretty much like we saw in muscle. And they have connective tissue surrounding all these. We call that the perineurium. Right, so neurium stands for nerve, not mesium for muscle. So here is a fascicle. So the building block of a nerve are all these fascicles. Right? But there's also blood vessels in here. So I can see a nice artery and a vein. This is bringing nutrients to all of these axons that need oxygen and nutrients. Right? And do you see any fine structure within a fascicle? Do you see things that make up a fascicle? Just like in muscle, right? We saw cells. And in a nerve fascicle, we see cells as well. Look at all these cells right here, hundreds of them. And these cells are carrying information in one direction. So here are nerve fibers, individual cells, and these are just what? Axons. And most axons in the peripheral nervous system are myelinated. So here I can see a certain kind of cell says myelin sheath. All right, what kind of cells are these that kind of make up this like line of pearls right here with nodes of Ranvier between the cells that produce saltatory conduction? Can you identify these cells right here? They are Schwann cells. And what's nice about these Schwann cells is that if this nerve gets damaged or cut, these Schwann cells right here promote regeneration. That's part of their job, so that a nerve can regrow back to its effector organ. That's only in the peripheral nervous system. All right, then, surrounding the axon, we have the myelin sheath. Surrounding the myelin sheath, we have another connective tissue layer called the endoneurium. So you got epi around the whole nerve, peri around a fascicle, and endo around each one of the axons that are surrounded by that myelin sheath. And a nerve could also have these blood vessels. So when we start doing dissections, we'll be able to find things like this, like the vagus nerve, for instance, in the neck. You'll see what a nerve really looks like, and maybe we can break some microscopes out and take a look at these fascicles and individual nerve cells right here. All right, so that's what makes up a nerve. What did I miss? Let's take a look at this. A nerve, you got epineurium, you got blood vessels, fascicles, perineurium, nerve fibers, nerve fiber or an axon, pretty much the same thing. Endoneurium, nice, the myelin sheath, and then that axon. All right, so that's the basic orientation or basic composition of a nerve that we find in the peripheral nervous system. And I'm sure that's an exam figure. Okay, here's what it looks like with an electron microscope. Let's talk about some basic organization in terms of physiology in the nervous system. I think we've looked at this already, but it's so important. We're going to look at it again. Okay, let's take a look at this slide right here. So here I see a cross-section of part of your nervous system. Can anybody identify this kind of oval structure right here? You can see this with your naked eye. You don't need a microscope. This is a cross-section of spinal cord inside the vertebral canal, right inside your vertebral column. And can you see white matter? Yep, that's where the cursor is. Can you see gray matter? Indeed you can, right? So just like the brain, the spinal cord has gray matter. Gray matter is deep. White matter is on the periphery or superficial in the spinal cord. So let's quickly review. All right, white matter. How should we consider white matter? These are tracts. Right, so these are axons either moving up the spinal cord or down the spinal cord carrying lots of information. So you could, this white matter here, you could think of like cables bringing information one way or the other. If that information is ascending to the brain, that's an afferent pathway. If it's a descending, if it's carrying information from the brain down the spinal cord to the periphery, that would be an efferent tract. So basically these tracts, you could define them to be either afferent or efferent. Now, what's in this gray matter? It kind of looks like an H. Anybody remember what's in gray matter? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites, not myelinated axons. And here is a nerve cell body, and there's some dendrites that we can't see on this. That's what that little illustration means. Right? And, of course, nerve cell bodies and dendrites are not myelinated. But then here is an axon. And what can you tell me about the axon of this interneuron? Is it myelinated or not? It's in gray matter. So here is a neuron that is not myelinated. Right? And since it's between a sensory neuron and a motor neuron, we call that an interneuron or an association neuron. So it's going to carry information from the sensory neuron to various places in the central nervous system. All right, so what do we got right here? Here is an afferent neuron bringing information into the CNS. We've got an interneuron. And then here is an efferent motor neuron. So let's add a couple things. Right here, we've got 5 items on this particular illustration. And it's deficient in 2 really important items. All right, so probably 1B should be receptor. What should 1A be? 1A. I see it right here. Oh, it's even written on this slide. It is a stimulus. So we see a nice response loop right here. A response loop always starts with a stimulus. right? In order for you to perceive a stimulus, right, then you have to have a receptor for that particular modality of energy. If it's light energy, then you need photoreceptor, right? If it's a change in temperature, then you need a thermoreceptor. If it's a change in a chemical, then you need a chemoreceptor. But in order to appreciate some stimulus inside the environment, whether it's in your body or outside, you need a receptor. So response loop always starts with a stimulus picked up by a receptor. That information then travels through this neuron, and this is what, an afferent neuron? Goes into the central nervous system. The central nervous system makes sense of that information, or kind of, I had to use the same word because here we have a sensory neuron, but it gives meaning to the content of that information is what an interneuron does. And an interneuron also can make a decision on what to do with that information, and it sends that decision down this efferent neuron. What's another name for an efferent neuron? Motor, taking information from CNS out to the periphery to some effector organ. Okay, and this particular, anybody recognize this effector organ? This is a nice skeletal muscle, voluntary control, right, under most circumstances. And what does this effector organ do? It's not on this slide. I don't see it anywhere. All right, so this would be like 5B or 6. An effector organ always produces a response, right? So draw that in, response. Do I have that? I do have all those things right here, right? So we see 7 items that make a response loop or a reflex arc. So a reflex or a response loop always starts with a stimulus and it ends in a response, and these are the anatomical pieces that you need. All right, let's look at some of these neurons by their shape. This one right here, I see the nerve cell body outside of the peripheral nervous system, and there's one process coming out that bifurcates. Can you identify this particular neuron by its shape? We looked at one earlier today. This is a unipolar neuron or pseudo-unipolar neuron. And what's the function of a unipolar neuron all of the time, 100% of the time? It is going to be sensory, right? Pseudo-unipolar, sensory. Nice. So there's going to be a group of these nerve cell bodies outside the central nervous system. What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies outside the central nervous system? Might have to look that up. We might want to label this thing. This is a ganglion. It's a group of nerve cell bodies, gray matter outside the central nervous system. Right? And then the central process enters the CNS where it stimulates this interneuron. Who knows what's the shape of this interneuron right here? What are your choices? Unipolar, multipolar, or bipolar? Okay, I see cell body way up over here, right? And then just one axon coming off like that. That is, and off of the cell body are many, many dendrites, so this is what we call a multipolar neuron. So interneurons are multipolar neurons. And then what about this motor neuron right here? What is it by its shape? Looks a lot like this interneuron. So again, that is a multipolar neuron. So motor neurons are multipolar. Sensory are unipolar. Association are multipolar. We haven't looked at any bipolar cells yet, right? But there we're going to find some when we get through the nervous system into special senses. Okay, so what kind of motor neuron is this that I'm looking at right here, going to the skeletal muscle? Is it a somatic motor neuron or an autonomic motor neuron? For those of you that were here from the beginning of class, you might be able to figure that out. Somatic or autonomic? Okay, let's go back to here. All the way back up, all the way back up, 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 up. Sorry, I should have just jumped up here. Okay. So where is this neuron going? What kind of effector organ is this? What does it look like? Skeletal muscle. So here are your choices for efferent neurons, somatic versus autonomic. If it goes to skeletal muscle, it is a somatic. So here you could just write down somatic motor neuron, right, which means it goes to skeletal muscle. if it was going to the heart, then you could say a visceral motor neuron or efferent neuron. But since it's going to skeletal, this is a somatic motor neuron under your conscious control. All right, I think, I'm almost done, but not quite with this chapter. The ways that information is processed in the nervous system, a couple different ways. Okay, we have different kinds of circuits. This is, and some circuits might be combinations of these things, but this is just a nice breakdown of how to conceptualize some of these nervous system circuits. We have diverging, so here is just a single neuron, and the axon bifurcates and then stimulates three, and then there's even further bifurcation to where you might have stimulation of tens or hundreds of other neurons. So starting with stimulating just one neuron, it eventually stimulates hundreds of them. That's what we call a diverging circuit. On the other hand, if we have a number of neurons all converging to a single neuron, so we have many inputs and one output, right, we call that a converging circuit. We'll talk about what the function of these things are in a second. So we got diverging, one input, many outputs, converging, many inputs and one output. And then here is a really kind of fascinating one. We have one input and one output. Well, that doesn't seem very special at all, right? One input, one output compared to this diverging and converging. But let's look at some of the internal connections in this reverberating circuit. So there's one neuron that's receiving information. It sends signals, stimulates a second, and then a third, and then a fourth that produces an output. All right. But what do we have? We have a bifurcation on this third neuron, which stimulates another neuron that is going in the reverse direction. So it goes back and stimulates the neuron that stimulated it. Right? So there is just like a little resonance that happens right here. Not only that, but this reverse orientation neuron goes back and stimulates the second neuron. Right? So this one right here, the reverse neuron gets information from this third and this fourth, the end neuron right here, it gets re-stimulated, and it re-stimulates this pathway over and over and over again. So if there is one input, this circuit right here is just going to ring like a bell for a long period of time. Even though there is just one excitatory event on the first neuron, this circuit will stay active until these neurons fatigue. And that should remind you of something that might produce or that produces a wakeful state. So what would be this input here? This would be, for instance, your alarm clock in the morning, right? And that stimulates this reverberating circuit in your central nervous system, and it stays active producing a wakeful state until these neurons fatigue and then you fall asleep later on during the day. So reverberating circuits are important for producing arousal or a wakeful state. And that's really handy. And it's really terrible if the circuit doesn't operate properly. And some people, it doesn't. They can fall asleep at any time. They could be driving down the freeway. They could be even taking notes in a really exciting anatomy lecture, and they'll just fall asleep. An instructor, all of a sudden, might just fall asleep giving a lecture. Okay? And does anybody know what that's called? When you can just fall asleep at any particular time, you can't stay awake because there's damage to this circuit right here in your brain. Wow, I think I forgot. I think it's called narcolepsy. Narcolepsy, when you can't stay awake. Okay? And this is in, what we're going to see where this is in the central nervous system. It's called the reticular activating system. Has a reverberating circuit. All right, so no diverging, converging, and reverberating. Diverging, one input, many outputs. Converging, many inputs, one output. And reverberating is one input, one output, but with just one single event of input, it produces what? Long periods of time where there is excitatory output coming from that particular circuit. Okay. So we're going to look at these different kinds of processing signals. All right, so that's it for the introductory chapter, which means then we can go to the next chapter, which is Central nervous system. All right, but somebody's got to tell me, what is central nervous system? And do you see any part of the central nervous system on the slide on the right? Do we see any part of it? We do. We see the spinal cord. So spinal cord is part of the CNS. And you know what? I just want to say CNS instead of central nervous system from now on. All right, so here's the spinal cord. What's another division of the CNS? Yeah, brain. I heard it someplace up there. All right, so let me, maybe I'll just put that away for now, move this over here. And where is our nice word slide of central nervous system? Here it is right here. Okay, so central nervous system, we got five general areas. So we're going to break this down into some general areas, and a good figure to look at, oh, I have it right here, a good figure to look at is this one, 13.14A. This is a really important exam figure. It's also a quiz coming up, not this week. Well, I don't know. The quiz that you have tomorrow is on muscles of the whole human body. This one could be on maybe Thursday. Or maybe next week, I'm not sure. We'll have to check the lab schedule. All right, so here we have a section through the spinal cord and through the brain. So we're looking at parts of the central nervous system. What kind of section is this through the central nervous system? Yeah, it's a nice sagittal. And if you want to say mid-sagittal, median, that's fine. It's pretty much right smack in the middle. Okay, and so we see a lot of stuff here. Let's start not at the top, but at the bottom, down over here. Okay. Central nervous system. Okay. So this is where the occipital bone is going to lie. And here is the foramen magnum in the occipital bone. So coursing through that foramen magnum is going to be the spinal cord. That's the origin of the spinal cord. It's a foramen magnum in the occipital bone. Everything superior to foramen magnum is going to be called the brain. Everything below is going to be spinal cord. So the first division, so let's think we have some signals coming from the spinal cord going up, ascending into the brain. How would you think of signals starting in the spinal cord moving up into the brain? Are they going to be afferent or efferent? Afferent, that's right. Ascending or sensory, bringing information to the brain. So let's think of it that way. Okay, is afferent information moving from the spinal cord into the brain. The first part of the brain that we're going to run into is, right here. All right, it's right here and a little bit right here. This first little bulge is what we call the medulla oblongata. Okay, and it's part of the brain stem along with the pons. The pons and medulla connect the spinal cord with the rest parts of the brain. So that's a pretty important area. But not only that, it has some really important functions. And this is a very ancient, ancestral part of brains. Even very lower forms of life have this part of the brain. This is what takes care of many things in your body that you don't have conscious thought over. Your heart rate. Constriction of blood vessels, dilation of blood vessels, breathing, swallowing, coughing, sneezing. So sometimes we might even call this the reptilian brain because it takes care of so many things that we just don't have to think about that just take care of themselves automatically, but not really part of the autonomic nervous system, just things that take care of themselves. It could be autonomic nervous system. Okay, and so here is the medulla. The first part, here is the second part, which is the pons. So we got medulla and pons. And a really important function of the pons, it acts as a relay center, a relay station. Right? So sensory information gets into the pons, and then the pons will share it with this part of the brain over here. And we're going to talk about this almost last. This is the cerebellum. So pons takes information from the spinal cord medulla, sends it into the cerebellum. This is really important for motor, coordination of motor activities in your body, voluntary motor activities. All right, there is something else. We just talked about reticular activating system. All right, there is an area that is shared between the pons and the medulla which we call the reticular activating system or reticular formation, that contains that reverberation circuit that keeps you awake once it gets stimulated. Right, so if somebody has a stroke in this part of the brain or a tumor or some kind of other abnormality, if it damages that reticular activating system, where do I have it? Relay information, midbrain. Oh, I don't have it here. Oh, reticular formation. Okay, part of the pons and the medulla, then that person can just fall asleep at any particular time. And if anybody knows about that, you'll lose your driver's license. And that's a really good thing because we don't want people like that driving down the freeway with us, right? Okay. All right, so that's medulla and pons. Above the medulla and pons, where I'm circling right now, this is no longer the brainstem. This is what we call the midbrain. Okay, so midbrain. Midbrain has a number of features to it. Here is a major connection between the brainstem and the cerebrum, which is up over here. It acts like a bridge. It's a big, major bridge. And big, major bridges in the brain have a really funny name. Probably never heard of it before. It's called a peduncle. A peduncle is a bridge. There are no nerve cell bodies and dendrites in there. It just contains myelinated axons carrying information both up and down. And that's a peduncle. Since it's going to the cerebrum, we call that the cerebral peduncle. That's part of the midbrain. Then we have a little chamber here. It looks kind of like a river. Fluid flows through this thing. We get across this little fluid contained compartment, we get to something that looks like it has a couple bumps, right? There are actually four. There are two on the right, two on the left, and I only see two right here. There's a superior and an inferior one. If we put all four of them together, we get the corpora quadrigemina. Corpora quadrigemina, part of the midbrain. So guess what quadrigemina means? Quadra is four. So you're going to see four of these things. The two superior ones are important for visual reflexes. It allows your eye to track objects that are moving in space. So once this area here recognizes an object, you don't have to think about tracking it. Your eyes just automatically will track an object that moves. So baseball players probably have a very sophisticated superior colliculus because they can track baseballs. And a baseball doesn't just move in a straight line, right? It curves, can wiggle around, can oscillate in space, right? Depending on the particular talents of a baseball player. And they can predict where a ball is going to end up, right? Even if they just see a little bit of the track of that particular ball. That's due to the superior colliculus of the corpora quadrigemina. So for visual reflexes and visual tracking. Right, so the midbrain doesn't give you any consciousness, right? So you can't think with the midbrain. All your consciousness comes from the cerebrum right here, right? But the midbrain can control eye motion, right, for tracking. So even if somebody's brain is dead, if somebody's cerebral cortex is dead, guess what their eyes do? Their eyes still can track objects in space. And when you observe somebody who is completely brain dead, won't have it, maybe this is all dissolved away already, the cerebral cortex, and you observe somebody, maybe you can shine a light in their eyes and move the light, and then their eyes move to track that light, you get the sense that they're actually looking at that light and making a conscious effort to track it. And that's really not the case at all. It's just a reflex, right? Just like if you were to poke their hand with a pin, their hand would move away from that painful stimulus. If the cerebral cortex is gone, they'd have no appreciation of that pain. It's just a reflex that is there, right, in lower parts of their central nervous system. Some very sad, interesting court cases regarding that. If maybe during lab we can talk about the Terry Schiavo case. Does that ring a bell for anybody, Terry Schiavo? She stopped breathing. And remember, stop breathing for 4 minutes, your brain is dead. That's just the way it goes. She stopped breathing for probably 15, 20 minutes, something like that. And so the cerebral cortex died, but she could still track objects in space because the corpora quadrigemina, right, was still alive. And certain family members said, oh, guess what? Her brain is still functioning. She's still a real person because she can, her eyes will attach to me when I walk in the room or when I move my hand around. Right? Another family member said, well, it's really a shame to keep her on life support because on imaging studies, it just shows fluid in the rest of the cranium. There's no brain tissue there. So here is somebody that's brain dead, and you have to make a decision. Should we take this person off of life support or not? Right? And that was really unfortunate because they kept her alive for a long period of time on a respirator, keeping her heart working, but she didn't have a brain left for months and months and months. At least she couldn't appreciate the torture she was going through, but still it's interesting. All right, so that's a superior colliculus. Inferior colliculus is not important for visual information, but for processing auditory information. Inferior colliculus of the corpora quadrigemina allows you to localize sound. So if there's sound coming from my right, it hits my right ear first before it hits my left. The inferior colliculus compares the time signature of when those signals are coming from my right or left, and it can tell if sound is coming from my right-hand side, my left-hand side, in front of me, in back of me. We call that localization, right? And I wish I had some volunteers right now because we could do kind of a really fast experiment. We could close our eyes and I could have somebody, oh, we got four doors here, open up one of the doors in the room. So if somebody opened up the door in the front on my right hand side, you think you could tell it was that door that was opening and closing with your eyes closed. And you probably maybe have a sense, yeah, you can, because of the inferior colliculus right here. Or if there's a door in the back without even looking, you would know where that door was opening and closing because of that inferior colliculus. Auditory reflexes. All right, so that's the midbrain. Cerebral peduncle, corpora quadrigemina. And then the last part right here is what we call the cerebral aqueduct. It carries cerebral spinal fluid between a couple important chambers inside the brain. Here is the fourth ventricle between the pons and the cerebellum. The third ventricle is superior to this midbrain, which is what we were just talking about, right? So it connects these two chambers, the third ventricle and fourth ventricle. All right, so that's midbrain. Reticular formation, part of the medulla and pons. We talked about that. Okay, let's review. What is the function of the pons? What did we say the function of the pons was? Relay station, right? Getting information from someplace, passing it on to another place, hopefully not changing the story. You know, like, ever done that? Like, tell somebody some information, they pass it on to another person, they pass it on to another person, and by the time it gets passed on to 10 people, the story has changed dramatically. Not so for this kind of relay station, okay? All right, so that's the pons. There's another relay station in this more superior part of the brain, which we call the diencephalon. So what have we talked about? Brain stem, midbrain, diencephalon is this next region with a relay station, and that's called the thalamus. The thalamus is important for afferent or sensory information. Things coming up from the spinal cord go to the thalamus. The thalamus then directs that information to different lobes of the cerebrum, like the occipital lobe, parietal lobe, frontal lobe, okay, or temporal lobe. So that's the job of the thalamus. It sends information to the proper parts of the cerebral cortex, which is where you have your consciousness taking place and your appreciation of reality. That's the thalamus. Another part of the diencephalon is below the thalamus, and guess what we could call something below the thalamus? Maybe you could think of a couple ways, but what could you call an area below the thalamus? And you want to say, you want to keep that term thalamus in there. What could you call this thing right here? What do we call that layer below the dermis? The hypodermis, right? And so here is the hypothalamus, below the thalamus. And that's important because it regulates a lot of things for us, like temperature, hunger, and thirst. And so if our body temperature increases, that's what causes increased respiration, causes sweating to cool our body down. And if we haven't eaten anything all day, this is the part of the brain that says, that sends information to your cerebrum that says, hey, you're hungry, you should probably eat something. Or if you're dehydrated, had too many margaritas with salt and become dehydrated, Right? That's the part of the brain that's going to give you the sensation that you're thirsty. And then, of course, when you're thirsty, then you drink to alleviate that sense that's coming from the hypothalamus. And another important part of the hypothalamus, function of the hypothalamus, is that it controls this area right here. This is not part of the central nervous system. This little thing underneath the hypothalamus, it sits right inside the cella turcica. Maybe that's ringing a bell in the sphenoid bone. This is the pituitary gland. All right, so that's a gland. It secretes hormones. It's a very important endocrine gland that controls many other endocrine glands in your body, like your testes, ovaries, okay, adrenal glands, and on and on and on. We're going to look at that in that endocrine chapter, the last chapter before your next test in here. So it's the hypothalamus that controls the pituitary gland. Pituitary gland sends out signals that control many other functions everywhere in your body because it secretes hormones. Remember, a hormone is something that gets put into the blood and it goes everywhere in your body. All right, so that's the diencephalon. The cerebrum, we see up over here. And in terms of size, what's its relative size between compared to the brain stem, the midbrain, and the diencephalon? What's a good way to compare the size of the cerebrum? Smaller? Same size, bigger, okay? It's the largest part of the brain. It's really, really big, right? So here is the cerebrum. And if you look at the surface of the cerebrum, does it look flat and smooth or does it look all wrinkled up? I see it's all wrinkled up, yeah. And so what do we call a depression in anatomy? Like I see a depression right here. You could call it a groove, but another name is sulcus. Yeah, so here is a sulcus. A depression on the surface of the brain is a sulcus, and then here's a raised area on the surface of a brain. That's not a sulcus. That's what we call a gyrus. We haven't looked at a gyrus yet. There's not another companion term to that for bone anatomy, but on the surface of the brain, that's a gyrus. So what does the surface look like? Well, we have a sulcus followed by a gyrus, followed by a sulcus, followed by a gyrus, followed by a sulcus, followed by a gyrus, followed by what? Do you get that point right there? Followed by another sulcus. So the surface of your brain is all folded up. And if the proper name for these folds is a convolution. So the surface of the brain is convoluted. What makes up a convolution? It's a sulcus and a gyrus. Those are the things in combination that make up a gyrus. All right, so cerebrum, largest part of the brain, there are convolutions on the surface made up of gyri and sulci. Okay. All right, well, let's break the cerebrum down into some manageable pieces. There are different lobes. There's a lobe underneath the frontal bone that we call the frontal lobe. There's a piece over here that is underneath the parietal bone, which is the parietal lobe. And then there's a piece way back over here that's deep to the occipital bone. Here is the occipital lobe. Those are three major lobes of the brain, and then there's one more, which I can just see peeking out a little bit. This is lateral, so we don't see it very well on a sagittal section, but it is deep to the temporal bone, so here is the temporal lobe. So those are your lobes, frontal, parietal, occipital, and temporal. They have different functions, all right, and so let's think of the frontal lobe right here first, frontal lobe. This is where you initiate skeletal muscle contraction. This is the part of the brain that's necessary to control your voluntary movement. All right, so sometimes we call that motor. It's the motor part of your brain because it's controlling motion in your body. Frontal lobe. Can anybody think of an easy way that I remember that's the motor part of your brain? It has to do with cars. Where do you have the motor in your car? Where do you have the engine? Where do you have the engine in your car? In the front. Yeah, most people have it in the front, unless you have kind of a funny car, it might have it in the back. Or if you have a really expensive car, they don't put the motor in the front or the back. They put this big heavy thing right smack in the middle. Okay, but most people's motors are in the front of the car, so think frontal lobe, motor for moving your body around. There's some special areas for motor, like speech. is a pretty complicated kind of activity because you have to coordinate it with breathing and a lot of different muscles, right? So, and that's called Broca's area, right? That's not sensory. You can appreciate spoken language if Broca's area is damaged. Maybe you have a stroke in Broca's area, you won't be able to pronounce words or speak a language, but if you hear somebody speaking, you can understand perfectly what they're talking about if another part of the brain is functioning. We'll look at that in just a little bit, right? So Broca for speaking. Okay, in the frontal lobe, there are some areas that contain just nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Oh, let me see if I can find them. Nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Okay, nerve cell bodies in the frontal lobe. Let's look at this slide right here. So here is, okay, so here is what, well, it's a transverse section. And then here is, so here's the anterior lobe. Here are some dark areas in that frontal lobe, right? And can you tell it's gray compared to this area here? So this is white matter. Remember, here these are tracts, and then this gray area, nerve cell bodies and dendrites. These are important for controlling motion in your body. These are what we call the basal nuclei. And I don't think I'm going to have you know the names of these things, like the caudate nucleus and putamen and globus pallidus, but these help control motor activity. When these things degenerate, then you have loss of control of skeletal muscle in your body. And these are the things that degenerate in Parkinson's disease. And people with Parkinson's disease have a lot of trouble moving. Okay, and in what sense? Well, here's something that's kind of fascinating. These basal nuclei right here inhibit motor activity. So you might say, well, why is that so important? Well, because without that inhibition, skeletal muscles have a tendency to stay contracted. All right, so think of your biceps and triceps. Does the biceps have an easier time or a harder time when the triceps cannot relax? Say the triceps stays contracted, what kind of job does the biceps have? A lot harder time because it's got to pull against the triceps that's contracting. Okay? So the job of these basal nuclei right here, which your body calls basal ganglia, right, inhibit things like the antagonistic muscle so that you have nice fluid motion in your body. If antagonistic muscles can't be inhibited, your motion is very staggered, right, and equilibrium is easily lost. And that's happened to a couple people, probably some really famous people. Suffer from Parkinson's disease. Does anybody know anybody? Any celebrities? Anybody familiar with celebrities? One I'm thinking of is an athlete, and another is a movie actor. Okay, I'm thinking of Muhammad Ali. Anybody hear of Muhammad Ali? He's a little bit before your time, but he was a boxer, like the best boxer in the world for years and years and years. And unfortunately, when he get hit in the head, it would damage, right, these neurons of the basal nuclei. And so later on in life, right, he had onset of Parkinson's disease. And if you were to watch him, his gait was very hard to move, very staggered. His speech was slurred, had very poor equilibrium. Okay, and that is due to damage of these basal nuclei, these gray areas in the frontal lobe. Right, another person, a celebrity that has early onset Parkinson's disease is, ever hear of Michael J. Fox? Probably some of you have heard of Michael J. Fox. Pretty interesting, funny actor, good actor. And he had an early onset, and it's rare that somebody has early onset Parkinson's disease. Usually happens later in life, unless you've had brain trauma, car accident or something like that, or boxer. And the other reason for having early onset Parkinson's disease is substance abuse. All right? And so people ask Michael J. Fox, well, were you ever a substance abuser? Did you ever use heroin or other kinds of designer drugs? And he said, no, I never did. I never did. And so his early onset could never be explained until a number of other child actors came down with Parkinson's disease, and they were acting on the same set that he did. I think it was Family Ties, a TV show. And what everybody suspects right now were that the producers of that TV show would give them illicit amphetamines or other kinds of stimulants to help them just be more active and be active for long periods of time when they had the filming set up, right? Because they just don't film for a couple hours, take a break. They film for, you know, 12, 24 hours at a time. And so somebody thinks that these children were slipped a drug, which then damaged this part of the brain for them. And that's really unfortunate to think of that. Okay, so another bottom line there is to be careful. I would only take pharmaceutical quality drugs if I were you, because you just never know what's in other kind of drugs. There's an interesting case of the frozen addicts. Anybody hear of frozen addicts? 60 Minutes did a really interesting study of them. There were a handful of heroin users in Great Britain. They got their hands on some heroin product that had impurities in it that bound to receptors in the basal nuclei and poisoned the basal nuclei to where they no longer can move at all. So they can understand everything around them, but they're just frozen in bed as a result of that, called the frozen addicts. Do a Google on it. I should probably put a reference in here. All right, so that's the importance of these basal nuclei. Very important, right, for motor activity in the frontal lobe. The prefrontal cortex. What is the prefrontal cortex? Well, prefrontal means even in front of what we consider the frontal lobe, right? It's the most anterior part of the frontal lobe over here. This is really important for cognition and for understanding social circumstances that you're in. And then it also helps adjust what the appropriate response that you should have to that particular kind of stimulus. All right, so this was found out due to brain damage of somebody. There's a person building a railroad called Phineas Gage. If you've ever taken a psychology class, this is like a classic example. Phineas Gage would drill a big hole to set some dynamite, and he packed the hole with dynamite, and they use a big iron bar to pack the dynamite into the hole, and as he's packing the dynamite, it exploded, and this big metal bar went right up between his mandible and out his frontal lobe, and it just missed his eye, so it was way anterior. So it destroyed the anterior part of his brain. He was still able to live, right? And he went back to work. But instead of being somebody that you could easily talk into setting dynamite charges and showing up to work on time and being nice with everybody and being a good worker, he became very obstreperous and inappropriate, show up to work late and was flashing the finger to everybody all the time. Right, so he became very inappropriate because the prefrontal area of the frontal lobe was damaged. So that's another important function of that frontal lobe. Okay, let's look at, let's go back to the brain. What was that, 14? All right, so here's that frontal lobe. Parietal lobe. A little bit different than the frontal. So if one thing you're going to remember about the frontal lobe is that it initiates motor activity. And the parietal lobe, on the other hand, doesn't initiate motor activity, skeletal muscle on the surface of your body. This is an area where you have sensory perception, which is what? The opposite of motor. So here is a sensory area from the surface of your body. And sometimes we call that somatosensory cortex, somatic meaning on the surface. So this is where you feel temperature, this is where you feel vibration, okay, and other kinds, pain, pressure, touch. So the parietal lobe is important for sensation. What about the frontal lobe? Not sensation, but motor activities. So frontal is efferent part of your brain. The parietal lobe is the afferent part of your brain. And so is the temporal lobe. I see the temporal lobe over here. One important part of the temporal lobe is for appreciating sound. This is where your primary auditory cortex is. So if you have a stroke in the temporal lobe, that will prevent you from hearing anything. You might be able to speak and move just fine, but you won't be able to hear anything. The occipital lobe. This is important for you to know. Occipital lobe is the place where you process visual information. This is where your primary visual cortex is. right? And then this information is passed on to some deeper parts of the occipital lobe and then even deeper parts of the occipital lobe. And so those are what we call secondary association areas. This right at the tip of the occipital lobe is where the basic visual information is processed, but you won't be able to appreciate like the difference between letters, right? So it's these deeper association areas that can compare light and dark areas and make sense of those things, like to form letters or to form patterns for you to appreciate things like pictures and things like that. So temporal is auditory, occipital is visual. A lot of other areas, especially on the, from the surface of your body, is the parietal lobe, and then the frontal is for motor activity. All right, so in this frontal area, we said there's a Broca's area for speaking, and in the occipital lobe, right over here, actually it's between the temporal lobe, which is hearing, okay, and the occipital lobe, which is visual, right between these areas is what we call Wernicke's area. Wernicke's area is important for understanding language, right? So it's afferent for language, not for speaking language, but for understanding. So how do you understand language? Well, you observe somebody speaking, that's the occipital lobe. You also hear somebody speaking, that's the temporal lobe. And then when you combine all those senses together in the secondary centers, like Wernicke's area, then that's what makes sense of what you see and what you hear in terms of language. Somebody has a stroke in this area, Wernicke's area, right? They'll be able to talk properly, right? But they won't be able to understand a single word that somebody's saying. And they might not even be able to understand what they're saying. Even though they can speak perfectly, it won't make any sense. Okay? So there's a lot of strange things that can happen in a brain depending on what areas are damaged and which ones are preserved. All right, so we're still in the cerebrum. Okay, cerebrum, we're still in the cerebrum. And when we looked at the cerebrum, we saw, right, some white matter and some gray matter. When we looked at those basal nuclei not too long ago, where are those basal nuclei at? Let me get those back up over here. Okay, so I see some gray areas, these nuclei, nerve cell bodies and dendrites, white areas right here. These are myelinated axons taking information to different parts of the brain. So here I see 1, 2, 3 basal nuclei with this white stripe going through them. Right? And this white stripe right here is called the internal capsule. And this is for purely, purely motor or sensory. You know what? I think it's all motor activity. Right? So purely motor tracts. Remember, neurons can only transmit information in one direction. So all these motor signals from the frontal lobe go through the internal capsule. And you can see this nice white matter right here. If there are tracts that are taking information from a superior part to an inferior part, or inferior to superior, they're going to be either ascending or descending tracts, right? We're going to call those projection fibers. So projection fibers through the internal cortex taking things down are projection fibers. There are other kinds of fibers. Here I see some more white matter right here. What do you know is in this white matter here? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites, or myelinated axons? White matter, myelinated axons. And here, so there's tracts. And these tracts are not going from superior to inferior, they're going from right to left. And these are what we call commissural tracts. So projection go from up and down, commissural go from right and left. And there's a big separation between the right and left sides of the brain. We call this the longitudinal sulcus. And the right side of the brain really doesn't know what the left side is thinking or doing, okay, except the right side can share information via this commissural tract. And this commissural tract on the midsection is called the corpus callosum. And if there's damage to the corpus callosum, again, you'll experience some really strange effects, like the Auditory center primarily is on one side of the brain. Mathematical ability is on the other side. Somebody with damage to a commissural tract, you could show them a couple numbers like a 1 and a 2. All right, and you could say, what number do you see here? And they'll say number 1. What number is over here? They will say number 2. And then if you ask them, well, add 1 and 2 together, what number do you have? Well, the information can't get to the mathematical center in the brain, and they just won't be able to tell you. Okay? So, again, a lot of strange things can happen if there are malformations or damage to these different kinds of pieces in the brain. All right, so commissural, right and left. Another kind of tract shares information in one side of the brain. Doesn't go up and down, doesn't go right to left, but within different lobes or gyrus of a brain. And that's what we call association fibers. So here are the three kinds of fibers. Let me see if I can find a nice illustration. There's one really nice illustration, okay, of these different kinds of fibers. All right, so again, I see the basal nuclei. Here's a tract carrying information from one gyrus to another. Okay, what do we call tracts that go from just one gyrus to another, but not across the brain and not up and down? That is association. What do we call tracts that carry information superior to inferior? Those are projection fibers. And fibers that carry information from different sides of the brain, those are commissural tracts. Right, and remember, they're tracts, so they are just what? Myelinated axons going someplace. All right, so we're sort of done for the brain at the moment. We're going to come back and look at a couple other things. Cerebellum. I see the cerebellum here and here. It's connected to the pons. Remember, the pons is that relay center carrying, giving information to the pons. It's important because it adjusts our posture and postural muscles to maintain balance and coordination. So for instance, maybe you're walking down the sidewalk and all of a sudden you trip on something and you're about ready to fall right on your face, but it's the cerebellum that notices that something is going wrong and it tells a whole bunch of other muscles to contract to control your body so that you don't fall. That's just one example, but it's doing all kinds of important motor activities all the time so that you can maintain balance and posture, even if something kind of knocks you off balance, right? The cerebellum is able to take care of that for you. So where is that cerebellum at? Let's take a look. 13. All right, so here are the lobes of the cerebrum, and here is the cerebellum. So what are some of these pieces that we looked at so far? Spinal cord, brain stem, medulla and pons, midbrain, the cerebral peduncle, corpora quadrigemina, cerebral aqueduct, the diencephalon, thalamus and hypothalamus, and then the cerebrum, the different lobes, frontal, parietal, occipital, and temporal lobe, and then another part of the brain, the cerebellum. All right, so cerebellum is not part of any of the other ones. It's a separate part of the brain. You can't really consider it a lobe of the cerebrum. Okay, didn't talk much about the spinal cord, so let's talk about that now. It starts at foramen magnum, and it goes down to the level about L2. When I say L2, what does that mean to you? Lumbar, second vertebrae, right? So the spinal cord doesn't go all the way down to the sacrum. It stops before it gets there. All right, so what does a spinal cord look like? Here's a nice spinal cord. All right, so here's a foramen magnum right here. So this is all spinal cord. And so you can see a cervical region, a thoracic region, lumbar region, right? And the spinal cord actually stops right where I have the cursor here. That's L2. Down below L2, I see a bunch of nerves going through the vertebral canal, but it's not spinal cord. These are actually nerves through here, because the spinal cord can't grow as fast as the rest of a person's body during development, right? So it can't keep up with the height growth within a person, but that's okay, because these nerves can take up that extra space. Do you see that the spinal cord in the cervical region here is thicker than in the thoracic region? Right? And that the lumbar region over here is thicker compared to the thoracic region. Does anybody have an idea why this region up over here and down over here is a little bit thicker compared to the mid part of your body? Anybody have an idea? Because that's where your appendages are attached, right? So there are more neural circuits and processing circuits in the spinal cord to control your arms and to control your legs. And in this thoracic region here, no arms and legs, you just don't have to have as many neurons in that area to control something that doesn't exist. All right, so if we look down here at the bottom of the spinal cord, I see that it comes to a tapered end. All right, let's zoom in over here. Nice. So do you see this conical shape right here, kind of a pointy end to the spinal cord? It kind of looks like a cone. That's what's called the conus medullaris, which is the end of the spinal cord. And what lumbar vertebrae would we be looking at right here? That's the end of the spinal cord. That is L2, right. So we have spinal cord above it, no spinal cord down below it. I do see this dark line. Do you see this dark line where I have the hand going over? Let's move it up. Dark line goes all the way down here to the coccyx, to the most inferior part of the sacrum. We call that the phylum terminale. Phylum terminale is not a nerve. It's connective tissue, and it just helps attach the conus medullaris to this inferior part of the vertebral canal. Without it, the spinal cord would retract up to the brain and damage all these nerves that are leaving the vertebral canal. So that conus medullaris is important, puts a little traction on the spinal cord so that it doesn't float around or retract back up to the brain, damaging all those nerves. Sometimes there's malformation of the phylum terminale. It doesn't grow. Okay, and as a result, the conus medullaris gets adhered to the sacrum or the coccyx. And then as somebody grows, then their spinal cord is slowly ripped apart when that happens, produces really severe neuronal deficits, and that's called a tethered cord. A tethered cord is when the spinal cord is adhered to the sacrum or the coccyx, and that has to be corrected as soon as it's observed, right, to just protect the development of the spinal cord. And then all these nerves moving down below L2 that reminded somebody of a horse's tail with a lot of hairs coming down from a tail of a horse, and so that's called the cauda equina. Cauda means tail, equina means horse, right? And so that's what cauda equina is, what we find below the level of L2. I do see some space between the spinal cord, okay, and the vertebral column, and there's a lot of fluid right in this area. That fluid is called cerebrospinal fluid. You have some of that fluid in the brain as well. It's continuous with this compartment, and if you get an infection of the brain, that could be really serious. You could die within hours, right, with encephalitis. And so sometimes we want to get some of that fluid out of the brain and spinal cord and observe it to see if it does have bacteria or fungi, or even if it's, there's blood in there. Shouldn't be any blood in there. So sometimes we have to stick a needle in between the vertebrae into this space right here and aspirate some of that cerebral spinal fluid out for analysis. And so where does somebody, and it's called a spinal tap, right? And so where would we want to perform a spinal tap? Above L2 or below L2? If it's above the level of L2 and we insert a hypodermic needle, and if you're just a little bit careless, then you can lacerate the spinal cord. And remember, spinal cord doesn't heal itself. It doesn't regenerate. So that's a permanent injury. So spinal taps are performed below the level of L2, and when a hypodermic needle is placed in here, if it touches one of these nerves, then the nerves have a tendency just to move out of the way as a result, right? So then that fluid can be removed and analyzed for blood. That would, if there's blood in CSF, that might be an indication of a tumor or some kind of hemorrhage or stroke inside the brain, if there's an infection, then you have some of those bacteria to find out what kind of bacteria they are and what kind of antibiotics can be used to fight that infection rapidly. Okay, so there's where we gotta stop, and we just got a couple other things to talk about in central nervous system tomorrow. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. So make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, please.